All right, let's turn in our Bibles again to John chapter 14. I'm going to finish up that passage that we began last week. So let me give you a bit of context here. John 14 is all about Jesus setting aside his own agony, his own anguish, and focusing on loving and comforting the troubled hearts of his disciples. You see that in chapter 14, verse 1. He says, "Let not your heart be troubled." Agonism. You're in agony. And he attempts to do that, by the way. John 14 is all about this. The disciples are troubled. They are in despair. They are controlled by anxiety. And Jesus attempts to bring them comfort through many wonderful promises. You're familiar with some of these promises. He promises them heaven in verse 2. "I'm going to prepare a place for you in my Father's house." He promises he's going to come back and receive them with him in verse 3. In verse 12, he promises they'll do greater works than he ever did once he leaves. In verse 17, he promises them the Paraclete, the Comforter, the Holy Spirit, who will be with them always, not just as Jesus was physically with them only when he was. Verse 27, he promises them supernatural peace. But after all of that, they're still in despair. You see the end of verse 27. After all those promises, he says, "Do not let your heart be agonizo. Don't be fearful." So they are paralyzed with fear. They are dominated by anxiety and agony. Now, we might ask the question, and I think it's a good question to ask, why such fear? Why such anxiety? Why such doubt? And there are a lot of reasons, a lot of secondary reasons, especially. Number one, Jesus in chapter 13 has announced to them that all of them will forsake him by the end of the night. He's also told them that one of them, one of the 12, is a traitor. And they're not exactly sure who it is. He's told them that there is going to be no physical kingdom in the immediate, and that's what they were waiting for. In fact, they were debating who was going to be the chief seats in the kingdom. Of course, they were guilty because they failed to wash his feet in chapter 13. So all of those and more were kind of secondary points of fear, anguish, guilt, doubt, despair. But there is a primary. There is a primary point that is leaving them in such discouraged place, a discouraged place. That's verse 28. "You heard that I say to you, I know." So over and over, we'll see this in this upper room discourse, Jesus tells them again and again, "I am leaving." And he's not going to Toronto. He's going to die. That's what he means. And listen, this idea that Jesus was going to die, it was crazy to them because they believed he was the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's the great confession. So let me show you this, right? We're going to turn to a few passages, but go all the way back to Matthew 16. And I want to show you a bit of a progression here. So one, two, three books to your left. This is about, let's say, 9 months to a year before Jesus' death. Now, there have been allusions already and even statements that Jesus is going to die. But now it gets intensely clear and serious. Matthew chapter 16 and verse 21, from this time, I think King James says forward, from this time forward, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the hand of the elders and chief priests and scribes, that's the religious leaders, be killed and be raised again on the third day. Now this becomes a 9-month relentless pattern. Chapter 17, verse 9. They were coming down from the mountain. Jesus commanded them, saying, tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. I'm going to die. Verse 22. And while they were gathering together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered to the hands of men, and they will kill. Chapter 20 and verse 17. As Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, and all of this is getting closer. So now we're several weeks, a few months, let's say. As Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves, and he said, behold, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes. They'll condemn him to death, hand him over to the Gentiles. They'll mock him, scourge him, and crucify him. Now go back to our passage, because if you thought that was relentless, let me show you what's happening in the upper room in the course of maybe 3 hours in John chapter. And I'm just going to go to chapter 14. We'll skip everything in 13. You could read that yourself. Go to chapter 14. This is every chapter here in the upper room. Verse 2. In my Father's house are many places in heaven, you might say. I would not have told you, for I go. In other words, I'm leaving. And again, I'm not going to Paris. I'm going to die. Verse 3. If I go. Read it, since I'm going. Look at the end of verse 4. And you know where I am going. All of these are announcements about his death. Look down at verse 12, the end of verse 12. Because I go to the Father. Look at verse 19. After a little while, the world will no longer see me, but you will see me because I live. You will live also. In other words, it's another way of saying, I'm going to die. The world's not going to see me anymore. And so this is just building. Look back to chapter 12, verse 24. This is Tuesday. So we're on Thursday in chapter 14. This is the previous Tuesday of the Passion Week. Verse 24. Truly, truly, I say to you, and he's given a farming illustration here. Unless a grain, a little seed of wheat falls to the earth and decays in the ground, it's going to remain alone. You hold that seed in your hand, nothing's happening. But if it goes in the ground and decays, much fruit or much life will come from it. Well, he's speaking of his death, and the crowd's not getting it, but the disciples have been hearing it. They should be getting this. Look at verse 32 there. And if I am lifted up from the earth, I'll draw him into myself. He was saying this to indicate what kind of death he was going to die. And listen, lifted up. The Jews never lifted anyone up in crucifixion. They stoned. So he's not only saying I'm going to die, he's saying I'm going to die the worst and cruelest and most cursed possible death in the day. I'm going to be crucified by the Gentiles. Now, all of that left the disciples in a state of trauma. They're all in Jesus. They've left their businesses. They have become outcasts, some of them by various family members, by their communities. They've been with him for 3.5 years, and now the religious leaders, they're not very fond of these guys either. They hear all of that, and no surprise, in chapter 14, the end of verse 27, Jesus says, do not let your heart be agonizo, and nor let it be fearful. That may be phobia. I didn't look that up. So why again? Why? So let me go a little bit deeper into this despair. I mean, I gave you some of the outside circumstantial reasons. But let me go a little bit deeper into this idea of Jesus' death and the cross. We live in a radically different circumstance than the disciples were living at this moment, because they lived on that side of the cross, and we live on this side of the cross. So we understand the cross. In fact, on our side of the cross was the Apostle Paul. He said in Galatians 6:14, I boast in the cross. Paul says, I find myself singing about the cross, praising God for the cross, thanking God for the cross. That's us. Because now we have the Gospels, we have the book of Acts, we have the apostles preaching, we have the epistles. We're on this side of the cross. They had none of that. We talk about the cross, we sing about the cross, we read about the cross, we pray about the cross, we have the Lord's Supper, it ties us to the cross, baptism brings us back to the cross, we have the resurrection. So we understand substitutionary atonement at the cross, justification by faith. They don't get any of that. And they didn't have the illuminating ministry of the Spirit, at least not like we do today. So the disciples' perspective on the cross was confusion. How could the Messiah die? How could the Son of God let his creation kill him? It was doubt. Maybe we are backing the wrong Messiah. It was worry. What next? It was fear. What are they going to do to us? Because unlike us, they see absolutely no benefit in the cross, none whatsoever. Now, all of that brings us to our passage, verses 28-31. So here's our passage. This is Jesus' endeavor to get what is now the 11, Judas is gone, to see the cross from his perspective. Because for 27 verses, he's tried to encourage them by what the cross would mean to them. I'm going to heaven. I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm coming back for you. You're going to do greater works than I ever did. The Spirit of God's coming. You're going to have a supernatural peace. But none of that helps. Because at the end of all that, at the end of verse 27, they're still in agony. They're in emotional despair. So now Jesus going to kind of flip the coin, and he's going to tell them what the cross means to him. And beloved, I want you to know, this is going to be some profound truth. Now, one way that this applies to us, just going in, is we tend to look at the death of a Christian loved one from our perspective. That's what the disciples were doing. What does their death mean to me? Oh, poor me. What's going to happen to me now that they're gone? How am I going to go on? Look at all that I'm going to be missing. That's what the disciples were doing. Jesus here now then is encouraging them and all believers to look at death from the perspective, in their case, of Jesus, from our perspective of the believing loved one. In other words, what their death meant to them more than what it means to us. So let me give you kind of the big picture here of the chapter, because I may not finish it. The disciples are thinking this: if you die, we lose. If you die, we lose. I mean, they walk into the room debating who's going to get the chief seats in the kingdom. They're expecting him to live so they can get their seats. Who's going to get the biggest slice of the kingdom pie? So they're all wrapped up in self, and they may not say it this way, but their thinking is, if you die, we lose. Now, Jesus wants them to see what they want. He wants them to see his death from his perspective, what his death will mean for him and all of the benefits that it will bring him, because he had given them a number of benefits it would bring them. So he wants to give him some benefits it's going to bring him. So here's the point. The perspective in which they view Jesus' death is going to make all the difference in the world. All the difference in the world. And it's the same with us in how we view the death of loved ones. There's a verse. Now, you all know this verse. You at some point have memorized this verse. But sometimes we don't like develop these verses. We keep them like in, you know, one little circle. But it just reaches everywhere. So 1 Corinthians 13:5. Paul says, love seeketh, I think just the King James, love seeks not its own. Now that's the principle that Jesus is trying to get across here. Now let me read you a quote from an author, and I don't know who this author is because I wrote this message like about 6 years ago. But let me read you a quote from an author. It is just for me, one of the most profound quotes I've ever read in my life. And I'll kind of break it up and I'm going to comment on it. So the author said this, death is the greatest determiner of real love. Now listen, I never would have thought that. Death is the greatest determiner of real love. And then he says this, was our love for them centered on their meeting our needs? Our emotional needs, our psychological needs, our physical needs, our spiritual needs. Was that what our love for them was centered on, what they could do for us? Or, he goes on to say, was it based on the best and highest welfare of the one who died? Now, let me read it again without stopping. Death is the greatest determiner of real love. Was our love for them centered on their meeting our needs? Or was it based on the best and highest welfare of the one who died? Now that's the message that Jesus is sending the disciples here. Start with this too. Remember the words of the Apostle Paul. Paul says for Philippians 1:21, for me to live is Christ. Now stop there. Paul's not talking about just any old life. He's talking about the greatest life a human could live, the Christ life. Paul says, for me to live life is to live for Christ, which is the best life that anyone could possibly live. You can't get any higher than that. But then he says this, die? Oh, that's even better. That's gain. That's advantage. That's benefit. I once heard a preacher say it this way, death for the believer is a gateway to glory. It's simply opening up a hatch and the believer leaving the darkness of this world and entering into the glory of God's presence. So everything Jesus is about to teach him here now is resting on this reality. And that is what death will mean for him. Now listen, just to be clear, what he's not teaching and what I'm not saying is we should start going around and praying for people to die. You know, I really love him, so I'm praying that he's going to die so he could enter into that gateway to glory. All I'm saying is when they do, the reality is that the death that they experience will bring them to a far greater place in every way than the life they were experiencing. And as Christians, they were experiencing the best life, kind of like Abraham. You know, listen, Abraham had a good life. He was a rich guy. He had a lot of stuff. But he lived his life looking for a city whose builder and maker was God. There was something better out there. All right. So with all of that introduction in mind, and, you know, I'll rush through the end just to get to the end here. So the question is then, okay, so what did Jesus' death mean for him? Because whatever it did, he was using it to seek to comfort the troubled hearts of the disciples so that they would rejoice instead of be in despair. So what did his death mean for him? Well, let's start. Verse 28. You heard that I say to you, I go away. But we've been hearing too much of that, you know. I go away, I will come to you, I'm coming back. If you love me, you would have rejoiced. If you love me. So you're in despair. You know I'm going to die. You're in despair because of that. But if you love me, you would rejoice. Now I'm going to give you, I think it's four reasons for them to rejoice. Four things that Jesus' death did for him that should be cause for rejoicing for them. And the first one here is pretty obvious. You would rejoice if you love me because I go to the Father. Because I go to the Father. Now, let's start with this. Unfortunately, the disciples' attitude at this point is probably more like ours than we would like to admit. And so here's what Jesus is saying. This is a conditional sentence. When he said, if you love me, here's what he's saying. If you really love me, or maybe a better way to say it, if you loved me like you should love me. The application is this, and I think you could identify. At this point in their lives, their love for Jesus was dominated by what he could do for them. Maybe another way to put it, at this point in their lives, their love for Jesus was dominated by their love for self. So Jesus is calling them to a higher kind of love, a greater, a godlike love, a love that desires what is best for the other person and not for self. So real love for Christ would rejoice in what his death would mean for him. Let me give you an example of this, by the way. It kind of plays out in another context. You remember John 21, the last chapter? So the disciples are fishing. Jesus shows up on the shore. He calls them to the shore. He makes breakfast and they're eating. And he has this conversation with Peter. Now it applies to all of them. But he's going to have it with Peter. It's personal. So he says, Peter, do you love me? And he uses the word agape, supreme Godward love. In other words, you love me more than you love yourself. Peter responds, Lord, I love you. But he uses a lesser word, phileo. Lord, I really like you. I'm fond of you. So Jesus again asks Peter, do you agape me? Do you love me with a supreme love? Peter responds, Lord, I really, really like you. You know, you're my friend. So then the third time Jesus asks him, he brings down, he doesn't use the word agape. He comes down to Peter's word. And he says, Peter, do you love me? In other words, he says, Peter, I'm not even sure you could claim that kind of love the way you've been acting. You've been fishing, you've walked away. So this is the tension here. Christ is calling the disciples to the highest form of love, which seeks and looks for the best interest of the other one and not a kind of a personal selfish love whose love is dominated by what this person could do for us. So what will Christ's death mean for him? That's the question. How will this benefit him? How will it be good for him? Let me give you a number like, you know, human ways here. And not human, but just a little list here. I mean, number one, it's going to take him out of this world. And from all of the cursing and the slander and the oppression and the persecution and the hatred that he's, as the creator, has experienced since he's come to live with his own creation, his own people. Number two, it's going to bring him into eternal fellowship with his Father. The fellowship he experienced before he came to this world. John chapter 1 and verse 1, in the beginning was the eternal word Christ, and the word was with God the Father. Well, now he's going back to God the Father. John 1:18, he came from the Father's bosom. So he's going back. That's what it's going to mean to him. Number three, he's going to return to his former glory. You remember, it's, what is it, 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 9. He was rich, but for our sakes, he became poor so that we who are poor might become rich. In other words, he left heaven's glory, but now he's going back. Also, number four, this is going to glorify the Father. His death will glorify the Father. I'm turning to John 17 and verse 4. I've glorified you on earth, having accomplished the work which you've given me to do. But now I'm going to glorify you in my death, is what he goes on to say there. Number five, Christ's death will purchase salvation for his bride. That's chapter 12, verse 24. I don't want to turn there for time. Number six, it will demonstrate his great love for the Father. You see that in verse 31 here, so that the world may know that I love the Father. In other words, his death and his obedience to the Father in death will show that he has a great love for the Father. Number seven, he'll be vindicated. Everything he is, everything he claimed, everything he said will be vindicated in his death and resurrection. And then finally, all of his work will be accomplished. Chapter 19, verse 30, when Jesus dies, his last words are, "It is finished," or basically his last words are, "It is finished." So all of that and more is wrapped up in this phrase, "I'm leaving, I'm going away, but if you love me like you should, you would rejoice because I am going to be with the Father," and that means so much, Jesus is saying. So that's what he's calling for, that they would see the benefit this would be to him, and because they loved him, they would rejoice for his sake. So that's the idea, and that's what he's calling for. Then he gives this little phrase at the end of verse 28, "For the Father is greater than I." You know, the cults love that phrase. I told you he wasn't God. You know, he admits right there that he's not up to the standard of the Father. He's not equal to the Father. But always remember, all of these phrases the cults like to pull out, you have to see them in the entirety of the biblical context and then even the immediate context. So just the context in John's gospel, Jesus again and again claims to be God. John chapter 1 and verse 1, John says, "In the beginning was the Word was God." Chapter 5, verse 16 through 18, Jesus claims to be God, and John writes, "And they tried to stone him because he was claiming to be equal with the Father." So even his enemies knew he was claiming that. John chapter 10 and verse 30, "I and my Father are one." John 20 and verse 28, Thomas says, "My Lord and my God." There's all the "I am" statements in John's gospel. "I am the bread of life. I am the way, the truth, and life. I am the light of the world. I am the resurrection and the life." I am all of those where he takes the Old Testament name of God and applies it to himself. So there's no question that John is claiming and Jesus is claiming that he is God. So what does he mean when he says that my Father is greater than I? Well, he's referring to having left his glory when he came to earth, his heavenly glory, but now he's, and his Father still has that glory, but now he is going back and he is going to gain that glory. I'll read 17:5. "Father, glorify me together again with yourself, with the glory I had before the world was, before I came into the world." So you won't even remember that, but just remember this. When you hear this kind of stuff from the cults, there are answers. Just remember that. There are answers. Then you can go get the answer. All right, application to us. How about this? In the Father's, when a believer dies, there is so much benefit, right? To live as Christ, to die as gain. There is so much benefit. So what benefit? Well, we go to the Father's presence. We are free from sin. We leave a sin-cursed world. Our faith becomes sight. We are reunited with other believers. I think a good way to sum it up is Psalm chapter 16 and verse 11. In the Father's presence, fullness of joy and pleasures forevermore. Picture a picture of joy. And it's just spilling into your cup and it's spilling over and you have more joy than you could handle. It's spilling out everywhere. How about Revelation 24? "God will wipe away all tears from our eyes. There'll be no more I won't get the order right. No more sadness, sorrow, crying, death, pain, suffering. I mean, how could we as believers, now I get, all right, Jesus wept at Lazarus too. How can we as believers be sad when the believer gains all of that? So instead of being consumed and paralyzed by sadness, and that's going to be there, maybe our joy can overcome our sadness. That time comes when we face this. Maybe our joy, when we think about what death really means for them, and if we really love them and want best for them, then maybe our joy could overcome our sadness. This is all about, you know, put off, put on, by the way. We have to put off old thinking patterns. What are old thinking patterns? What their death means to me. And we renew our minds by understanding biblical truth, and we put on new thinking patterns, what their death means to them. Our minds are renewed. All right, let me try to wrap up these three other reasons here real quick. What Jesus' death meant for him. So number one, he goes to be with the Father, and that's really the big deal here. Number two, look at verse 29. Now I have told you before it happened, so that when it happened, I told you I was going to die before I'm going to die, so that when I die, you may really, really, really believe. So number two, Jesus here is proven to be a loving shepherd. And his death will mean that their faith will be strengthened. That's what's going to happen. And listen, they really need that at this point. You know, I don't have to tell you that. They're not ready for what lies ahead when he leaves. They need their faith to be strengthened. Now think about this. What if Jesus just left them in the dark about this? They believed right up to, you know, that Friday morning when they show up at Calvary and Jesus is crucified. They believed the kingdom was coming. And listen, there's a sense they did, because they never believed him when he was dying. But they did have a sense of it, obviously. But what if he never told them, completely caught them by surprise? Well, they would have thought that he was a victim of evil men, that he really wasn't the eternal Son of God. He wasn't the king that the Old Testament promised. So over and over again, you get this kind of phraseology here in verse 29. I'm telling you this before it happens, because when it happens, then you'll be like, oh boy, he told us he really was in charge. He does this. Look at chapter 13, verse 19. From now on, I'm telling you before it comes to pass, so that when it occurs, you may believe that I am, you may be absolutely certain that I am he. Look at chapter 16, verse 1 through 4. This is a good one for us, by the way. Chapter 16, these things I've spoken to you that you might keep from stumbling. So I'm telling you ahead of time, so that when this stuff happens, you just don't give up, hightail and run. They, the world, will make you outcasts from the synagogue, but an hour's coming, and everything you kill as you think they're offering service to God, these things they will do because they have not known the Father or me. Now this happens to the disciples. But these things I have spoken to you, so that when the hour comes, when they happen, you may remember that I told you. These things I did not say to you at the beginning because you couldn't handle it, but I'm telling you now. So over and over again, Jesus warns them of the future, in as a way of loving them and strengthening their faith. And when it happens, they're like, oh, and they believe even more. So verse 29, I've told you this before it happens, so that when it happens, you may really believe. Why would they believe? Because Jesus told them. Well, he was telling us that. We didn't get it. All right, let me go. Number three, what Jesus' death meant to him, for time's sake. So they should rejoice in Jesus' death because of what it means for him, because of what it means for them. Their faith will be straightened. Also, number three, because of what it means for Satan. Verse 30, I will not speak much more with you, for the ruler of this world is coming, and he has nothing in me. I'm about to defeat Satan. So this is the fulfillment of the Old Testament promise, Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, where Jesus in the garden, God in the garden, Jesus, says to Satan that there is going to be a human who is born of the seed of the woman, and he's going to come and deal with sin one day, and you're going to go after him, and you're going to bruise his heel. That's the cross. Satan bruised Jesus on the cross. It was real suffering, but he on that same cross and through the resurrection will crush your head. So this here is the fulfillment. My death is going to be the final blow to the ruler of this world. Let me deal with the phrase for a moment, the ruler of this world. Look back at chapter 8. I won't show you all these, but at least I want you to see this. I think it's so important. So here's the question. When the Bible calls Satan the ruler of this world, and it does a number of times, what actually does it mean? Well, let me show you. Chapter 8, verse 44. In this case, it means this. He rules through his followers. You are of your father, the devil, Jesus says to these Jews, religious leaders, and you want to do the desires of your father. So those who don't follow Christ, they may not know it, but they're following the ruler of this world. And their desires, their values, their actions are according to his desires. That's why you see all this murder in the world. That's why you see all the immorality in the world, all the hatred in the world, all the greed in this world. All of that is Satan, like father, like son. By the way, another way you see Satan as the ruler of this world, I'm not going to take you there, 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 14 and 15. Don't be surprised when false teachers come across as angels of light, truth teachers, because they're just being like their father, who is an angel of light and was a deceiver from the beginning. So another way that Satan rules this world is through false religion. Third way he rules this world is through the various values and the earthly wisdom of this world. That would be 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 6. It talks about Satan being the ruler of this world and he kind of the wisdom of this world. And then the last way, by the way, is 1 John 5:19. The whole world lies in the lap of the wicked one. In other words, he controls the cosmos, the world, the cosmos, the world system. He has designed a system so that he might control his followers to move them in the direction that he wants to move them. That's why when Jesus gets arrested in the garden in Luke chapter 22 and verse 53, 1,000 men come and they represent the whole world. The religious leaders are there, the Jews are there, the Romans are there. And Jesus says this, "This is your hour, Satan, the power of darkness." In other words, Satan is controlling all of that on an earthly level. Now he's on a leash and God's controlling it on a heavenly level. But Satan is moving his people to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. But no matter what he does, look at the last phrase, verse 30. He has nothing in me. There's nothing he could do to defeat. He can't even land a blow, you might say. So Satan from the beginning, he tried to destroy the human race in the garden to thwart God's plan. Adam and Eve sinned, soul of sin is it shall die. He tried to kill what he thought was the promised one in Abel. Cain killed him, but it wasn't through Abel. He tried to wipe out Israel throughout the Old Testament so that the Messiah wouldn't come. He tried to disqualify the line of David so Messiah wouldn't be in the line of David through sin. He tried to kill baby Jesus when he was 2 years old in Matthew chapter 2. He tried to disqualify Christ by tempting in the wilderness in Matthew chapter 4. He tried to stop him through the religious leaders killing him before his time. He tried to disqualify him, you remember, through false witnesses who would try to get some sort of sin to stick to Jesus, and thus he wouldn't be able to die for sinners. One of the ones we don't ever hear about much, he tried to beat him so much in Pilate's Praetorium Hall that he wouldn't go to the cross. Remember, Pilate comes out and he says, "Isn't this enough? Look at him. Why do we have to send him to the cross?" He tried to lie about the resurrection. The disciples stole the body. He tried to nullify the message of the resurrection by persecuting the church. On and on, nothing worked. Nothing Satan does can ever truly lay a glove against Christ. If the disciples knew all that, they would rejoice. If they knew that the cross and the resurrection would be the ultimate defeat of Satan, they would rejoice. All right, let me give you the last one briefly. So number one, they would rejoice over his death if they knew what it meant for him. They would rejoice if they knew what it meant for them. Their faith would be strengthened. They would rejoice if they knew what it meant for Satan. Number four, they would rejoice because it demonstrated of what it demonstrated to the world. Look at verse 31, what it demonstrated to the world. But so that, so you could read it this way. You heard I'm going away. If you love me, you would rejoice. So that for this reason, the world may know that I love the Father and I do exactly as the Father commanded me. So they would rejoice if they knew what Jesus was about to do on the cross, demonstrate God's love to the world. So Jesus' death isn't proof of his defeat. It's proof of his love for the Father and for the elect for whom he would die. Get this, by the way, just file this away in your thinking. Jesus died first and foremost, not for you and me. First and foremost, he dies for the Father. And then those the Father gives him. He dies out of obedience and love to his Father. And when he does that, the Father gives him the elect, the prize, an eternal prize, the bride, if you will. And what that all demonstrates, look at chapter 15, verse 10, and I'll close with this. All right, if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love just as I kept my Father's commandments and went to the cross, abide in his love. So it sets the standard, his death, for what real love for God looks like. It looks like Jesus going to the cross. It looks like supreme obedience. Real love for the Father looks like supreme obedience, supreme sacrifice. Then there's this last phrase here. I'm going to wrap it up. This is like a debatable phrase. Jesus says, get up, let us go from here. Now that means one of two things. It either means, and I used to take this view, that Jesus, all right, it's time to go. We're leaving the upper room. We need to get to the garden. But they don't yet go. And they have two more chapters of conversation and prayer. So really good people believe that. They don't actually leave till the end of chapter 17. I changed my position on it when we were studying it. And I've come to believe now that it means that they left right on the spot. In chapter 15, I'm not going to go through this whole thing with you. It takes place in the temple. And that just brings so much rich drama to chapter 15. If you see it taking place in the temple as they leave the city, big celebration of the temple. And on the face of the temple, there's a picture of a vine. It's all in gold and jewels. And he talks about, I am the vine, and they're there. And they're all looking at the vine. Another sermon for another day. Then chapter 16 and 17 take place down the Kidron Valley. They kind of stop for a break. Jesus teaches them in the moonlight and prays for them. And then at the end of chapter 17, verse 18, they make it to the Garden of Gethsemane. Anyway, all of that's all of that. Let me just close in prayer. Lord, I love these chapters, and I love all of the truth that they teach us. Lord, I pray we are going to need to file this truth, that real love loves others for the highest good and the highest benefit that could come, and not simply for what they can do for us or what they mean to us. Lord, I pray we would remember that at all times, but especially when loved ones go home to be with you. We need it then, Lord. And may our weeping and our sorrow, which is natural and human, may it be overcome by our joy for what you've done. Father, we'll thank you for it. In Jesus' name, amen.